You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Shashank Joshi, who'll be leading us through the three stories to keep your eyes on today. Shashank, what do you have for us?
I thought we'd talk about Islamists, both in Egypt, in the UAE, and even in Iran.
Also coming up on the programme...
You wonder why people would jump out of a 30, 40 story block window when fires are about. Well, I know why now, because I jumped.
It's 25 years since the deadliest oil platform disaster, but what, if any, lessons have been learned from the catastrophe? We'll ask the filmmaker of a new documentary on the subject, how the oil industry has changed since the Piper Alpha disaster.
And Africa's literati descend on London for the second annual celebration of the written word on the continent.
There seems to be much less of trying to explain Africa to the world. It's actually Africans conversing with themselves in some way, shape, or form.
Plus, does food really have the power to change the world? Well, some people think so. We're in Bolivia to find out.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes coming up for a Friday edition of Midori House. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. A mass protest is planned in Egypt today by those angry at the ousting of President Morsi by the army. Members of the Muslim Brotherhood, which supported Morsi, have called for a day of peaceful demonstrations. Egypt's new interim leader, Adli Mahmoud Mansour, has promised new elections, but the Brotherhood has rejected his overture to take part in talks. A veteran Egyptian politician says the fall of President Morsi was a second uprising, not a coup. Former Foreign Minister Amr Moussa says it was a decision made by the people, not by the army. And Mr. Moussa said Egypt must now move on.
The elections will come within a few months. And I am in favor of a short transitional period. Egypt cannot afford a long one. We need to rebuild the country with policies of short, medium, and long range. And this should have a government duly elected in order to assume this responsibility.
Islamist gunmen have carried out a series of attacks in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula region. One soldier was killed and two wounded when a police station on the border with the Gaza Strip came under rocket fire. Earlier, attackers fired rocket-propelled grenades at army checkpoints guarding El Arish Airport, close to the border with the Gaza Strip and Israel. It's not clear whether the attacks were a coordinated reaction to Morsi's removal. North Korea has accepted a South Korean proposal for talks on the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Zone, which has been closed since April. A previous attempt to hold talks on the complex, which lies just inside North Korea, failed amidst a row over protocol. A South Korean Unification Ministry spokesman says the talks are due to take place at 10 a.m. local time on Saturday in Panmunjom, the abandoned village on the de facto border between the two countries, where the truce which ended the Korean War was signed in 1953. President Obama has honored the military as part of the Independence Day celebrations at the White House. At the traditional July the 4th gathering on the White House lawn, the president told servicemen and women that it isn't just Americans who appreciate their efforts and sacrifices.
People in scattered corners of the world live in peace today, are free to write their own futures because of you. Defending our nation and our freedoms with strength and with sacrifice is your daily charge, and it's the charge of all who serve worldwide, including our troops that are still in harm's way and their families back home. They serve too, and so we think of them, we pray for them, and on behalf of all Americans, I want to say thank you and wish you all a very, very happy 4th of July. You've earned it.
A former lover of a billionaire Hong Kong tycoon has been jailed for 12 years for forging her will. Peter Chan had been found guilty of changing the will of Nina Wang, who died in 2007, to make himself the sole beneficiary of her estate, believed to be worth around $4 billion. In March, 53-year-old Chan was ordered to pay just under $44 million in tax arrears. He also faces a huge legal bill in connection with the long battle over Wang's estate, which he lost in 2011. Pakistan's new Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif met his Chinese counterpart Li Keqiang in Beijing on Friday and oversaw the signing of agreements between the two allies. The two men met in the Great Hall of the People on Tiananmen Square, and they attended a bilateral meeting with both countries' delegations present. With the help of one of his officials, Mr. Sharif paid glowing tribute to the relationship between the two countries.
Our friendship is higher than the Himalayas and deeper than the deepest sea in the world. This is and sweeter than honey.
I think that's what you call laying it on with a trowel. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. Well, it's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us in the studio is Shashank Joshi, a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Many thanks, Shashank, for coming into the studio. How are
you? Morning. Very well, thank you.
Good. Well, obviously, everyone's still talking about Egypt, but particular angle you want to talk about is the relationship with the Islamists and and other factions within Egypt.
Well, I think there's a few things worth pointing out. First of all, this isn't about Islamism versus secularism. I think it's really important we get that message out. There were Islamists, plenty of them far more extreme than the Brotherhood, Jama'a Islamiyah, a former terrorist group, which had actually been assisted by Morsi. It's been given posts in government, even though it had participated in terrorist attacks in tourist provinces in the 90s. The Noor Party, Salafists, which i.e. ultra-conservative Islamists who had done surprisingly well in Egypt's parliamentary election. All of those groups were arrayed against Morsi as well. So Islamism isn't going away. This is a reassertion of the old Mubarak elements of the Mubarak era state, but Islamism is still very much there. And the question I have is, if there are early elections or any elections, parliamentary, presidential, what if the Islamists win again? Forget about the Brotherhood. What if the Salafists win? Even more extreme. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, what does this mean for the long-term development of Islamism in the region? Because the lesson here is what? It seems to be, if you win fair and square, and even if you make some mistakes, overreach, power grabs, you won't be allowed to keep the spoils of your victory. So why participate in democracy in the first place?
I mean, I think it's quite interesting to look at the dialogue around this idea of democracy and Islamism. A lot of people are saying, well, actually, has Islam, you know, these Islamists failed in, you know, even achieving democracy?
Well, I think that's true.
That's something that we should be looking at.
Certainly, they should be treated like any other governing political faction. And in that respect, I'm glad these huge crowds came out to condemn and vilify Morsi's appalling government that couldn't really fix the economy, couldn't really keep to its promises. But of course, that's true of every attempt at governing in Egypt. The army, when it was running Egypt from the point that Mubarak fell to the point until Morsi took power, ran Egypt into the ground. It was just as bad as running the economy. So the idea that the Islamists are uniquely undemocratic is just nonsensical.
Do you think there's any fear then, you said there, why bother in elections if you're just going to be thrown out a year or two later? Is there a fear then that there could be potentially the radicalization of some Islamist elements within Egypt?
I think so. The dominant example is Algeria in the early 90s, which had an Islamist election victory and was subsequently overturned, leading to a brutal civil war. Now, Egypt is not Algeria for a host of reasons, and the Brotherhood has tried violence in the past. It began in the 50s, a subversive, violent organization, and abandoned violence, seeing more opportunities in politics. The danger, I think, is really that they become more underground, more secretive, focused on what many of their members wanted, which was dawah, that is outreach, social outreach, religious outreach, Islamizing from the bottom up, not Islamizing from the state apparatus down. And that will make the traditional secular elements in Egyptian politics more paranoid about what they're up to. And the second topic I wanted to discuss, the UAE, is a great illustration of that dynamic.
Well, let's talk about the UAE and actually leave Egypt for a moment. There's been a trial of several, dozens and dozens of Islamists.
Well, over 90, I mean, yeah.
in recently a very significant trial for that country and condemned really by many human rights activists. What does this mean for the UAE?
Well, Human Rights Watch called it one of the lowest points for the UAE's human rights record. And the UAE is not a democracy. It's in many ways in its social norms more liberal in its rules about dress, alcohol, daily life, less restrictive than many Arab and Muslim majority countries. And as people would argue, they reject Islamism as even a legitimate political force. But really, what this trial shows us is how paranoid, not just the Emiratis, but the entire Gulf, apart from one notable country, is about the Muslim Brotherhood and about political Islam more generally. They're not opposed to Islam. Saudi Arabia, Wahhabist country, Wahhabist mosque, long history of encouraging extremism abroad. They're not afraid of Islam or even extreme Islam. They're afraid of political Islam that challenges the tenets of the state. They like to keep their Islam and their governing separate, much as in Saudi Arabia in some respects. In the UAE, this flagrantly unfair trial has been about fears that Islamism is on the rise across the region since the Egyptian revolution of 2011, fanned by countries like Qatar, who they see as pumping up the Brotherhood through Al Jazeera and other channels. And really, in the Emirati case, what we're seeing is a complete unwillingness to even let them associate in public. It's a basic denial of the rights of free association.
What's the role of the royal family in the UAE in all of this? A lot of criticism, obviously, for them.
Which royal family? Because, of course, there are multiple emirates, and the most powerful of which, since the financial crisis in Dubai, has been Abu Dhabi, which is generally far more conservative, far more sceptical of Islamism. Dubai is more freewheeling, anyone who's been there will know it's more cosmopolitan, more liberal, more open. There are Iranians teeming in Dubai, smuggling, trading legitimately, engaging in commerce. And Abu Dhabi has always been a bit more sceptical of all of that. It's sceptical of two things. It has two big fears in Abu Dhabi in particular. The Iranians and what the Iranians may be up to in provoking, mobilizing the Shia minority in that country. And secondly, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, which they see as a big tentacle-based network spreading its sort of evil arms across the Middle East, radiating from Egypt outwards, from Hamas to the Muslim Brotherhood to everyone else. And from that point of view, they from the royal family, sees this as a direct threat to its own long-term security and stability.
And we should say this trial was early this week, but it includes sentences up to 10 years for academics, lawyers, members of some prominent UAE families.
Yeah,
these
absolutely
are high-profile candidates, and this case has repercussions for foreign policy. I mean, this is an ally of many of the Western countries. How do you think the West will respond to this trial?
Well, when you're trying to sell lots of Eurofighter Typhoons, which are worth enormous sums of money to a country, you interestingly tend not to bring up these awkward subjects in discussions when your focus of your meetings is to flog lots of arms. And of course, right now, we just had a state visit from the UAE. There's an interest in a strategic partnership. We use their airbase, the Al Minhad airbase. It's our main hub to move forward forces in and out of Afghanistan. And we see the UAE as a critical military node for any operations in the Gulf, including future operations against Iran. And on top of all of that, there's the money angle. We want to sell them lots of expensive stuff. And really, people in the world aren't buying arms anymore. It's only the Asians and the Arabs who are buying this stuff. So at the end of the day, this isn't going to be raised an awful lot. I wouldn't expect the Americans or the Brits to bring it up in public more than maybe in a very pro forma way. And I think that has really worrying consequences for how our approach to the broader Gulf evolves.
And Shashank, you mentioned there, obviously, Iran's influence in the entire region. A new leader, he seems to have been changing his calls. Should we be encouraged by these calls?
Absolutely. The reason I fit him into this category is, of course, he's an Islamist. You know, everyone in Iran is who's competing for office. More than that, he's the only cleric who was in the running for the election. We forget about that. He's not a reformist. He's a pragmatic, moderate conservative, but also a cleric. And so we see sort of more varieties of Islamism and how diverse this phenomenon is. Now, if anyone who's followed him on Twitter, anyone who's seen his statements will know he's been making hugely encouraging statements over the past several days or so, calling for more personal freedoms, calling for the Iranian state to remove itself from probing into the lives of Iranians. And he's made very positive calls for women's rights, saying that he's against segregation. He's in favour of allowing women to work. Now, it's questionable whether he can push some of these rather bold changes through what is a fractured system where power is distributed widely and, of course, is ultimately controlled by the Supreme Leader himself. But here's the thing. Rouhani isn't like Mohammad Khatami, the president 10 years ago, was a reformist, a liberal whose moves are seen as unraveling the Islamic Republic. He's an insider. He served at the right hand of Khamenei, at the head of the Supreme National Security Council. He's a cleric. So his gains may be more trusted. It's like a Nixon to China sort of phenomenon. He may be able to do more and earn the trust of the establishment, which is a great thing in my eyes.
And he's also targeting the broadcasting network there, really saying, actually, we're not reporting our own politics and social affairs with any sort of objectivity. This is quite an interesting sentiment coming from this man.
It's fascinating. I just wouldn't have expected it at all. And of course, you have to be a little cynical. He's operated at the heart of the system. He had plenty of opportunities over the past 15 years to say much of this. But you're absolutely right. I mean, compare that to Turkey, which Turkey's Turkish language CNN channels were broadcasting documentaries on penguins during the riots. And did Erdogan say anything? Did Turkish politicians criticize their own media? Lots of Turks did, but we didn't see anything. So I think if this is a sign of what's to come, a sort of incipient perestroika, three cheers.
Three cheers indeed. Shashank, thank you very much for joining us. As ever, that was Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Thank you very much again.
Coming up, we'll be looking at one of the deadliest accidents in the history of the oil industry and ask how the Piper Alpha disaster continues to shape the industry today.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of this work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:17. Now, this weekend marks the 25th anniversary since the deadliest oil platform disaster in history. The Piper Alpha platform in the North Sea was devastated when an explosion and fire engulfed and claimed the lives of 167 workers. There were only 61 survivors. Now, an investigation into the disaster blamed the owner, Occidental Petroleum, for poor maintenance and safety standards.
To mark the anniversary, a new film titled Fire in the Night looks back at that devastating set of circumstances. The film also hears from many of the survivors, some speaking publicly for the very first time.
You wonder why people would jump out of a 30, 40 story block window when fire's at the back. Well, I know why now, because I jumped.
But as survivors of the disaster and people in the industry look back and reflect on that horrendous day, some argue that not enough lessons have been learned. In many ways, history could be repeating itself for another disaster. Joining us now on the line is the film's director, Anthony Wonke. Anthony, welcome to Midori House. Tell us a little bit more about the details of this disaster. I mean, it's hard to underestimate its significance in the history of oil drilling. 167 workers, really very fresh in the minds of many survivors.
I mean, it was a huge disaster at the time. Piper Alpha in the mid-80s was one of the largest oil platforms in the North Sea. And it was a very busy platform. And one night, it was a warm July evening at 10 o'clock, and people were doing what they're usually doing. And there was an explosion and that caused a fire, and then another series of massive explosions. And literally within the space of about 90 minutes, the rig, the bulk of the rig melted into the sea, killing 167 people. So it was, at the time, it was a huge disaster. And I suppose in some ways, the reason why we're doing this film is because it was a story that was very big at the time, but then kind of got eclipsed by lots of other stories. And the BBC decided that they thought it was worth looking back at that event and hearing from the survivors and their horrific testimonies.
Absolutely, Anthony. And the film, of course, is called Fire in the Night. Congratulations, first of all, on the Audience Award at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. As Sophie mentioned, many of those survivors speaking publicly for the very first time. What do you think compelled those survivors who hadn't spoken publicly to come forward and open up to you in a very personal way?
I mean, this film was about 4 years in the making, and a lot of the credit goes to Stephen McGinty, the writer of the book that this is based on called Fire in the Night, and the cameraman Paul Beriff, who was actually making an observational documentary for STV at the time about helicopter rescue. And he had just finished. He got a call saying there was a fire on a rig. He went out and he shot that incredible material. And I think because those two men, one because one of them was there, and the other, that Stephen had written such a comprehensive and respectful and sensitive book, that I think that these men, the survivors, looked at that and I thought, well, these guys are credible and they wanted to take part. They also, I think, retracted the idea that this was 25 years down the line. That was a good long period to, I think, give a kind of honest and considered sort of approach to it all, and that it was for the cinema, and that they felt that brought a certain sort of credibility to it. And, you know, then I came on board, and I think it was a kind of a period of a sort of, you know, not persuasion, but letting them understand that this was hopefully going to be the definitive film on the disaster. And I think for some of them, it was a really cathartic experience.
And the notion of blame is addressed in the film, looking at whether or not there were safety procedures breached, and you know, what we can actually learn from that disaster in modern drilling techniques. I wondered whether or not your subjects have a view on that.
I think that their view was, at the time, that was the culture. It was health and safety was very different then than it is now. I think there was a much more sort of cavalier approach to the industry at that time, and I suppose what they really realised is that they didn't really consider how bad it was going to be, and I think all of the kind of protocols that they had in place weren't really prepared for something of this magnitude. Well, Anthony, go on.
Anthony, you say, you know, they had back then perhaps a cavalier approach some 25 years ago. You know, if you discuss oil platform disasters, many people will probably think of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Have we learnt enough lessons? You know, there have been reports recently where whistleblowers have been saying that different oil companies have been kind of fudging on the way they do their safety records so as not to seem as many accidents are actually happening on oil platforms than they actually are.
It's difficult for me to tell. I mean, I actually went offshore last year before I did this film and had to go through the kind of rigorous training. And I do get a sense that it has changed. I do get a sense that Piper Alpha was a massive landmark in terms of trying to change the industry. It's a dangerous business. I mean, you are drilling out in hostile territories. You're dealing with Mother Nature, and it's precision engineering, and it is a dangerous business. I don't, whether or not health and safety has changed, I think it probably has, but there's bound to be always going to be problems, I think, when you're drilling that deep.
And finally, I wondered whether or not there has been a sort of healing process while you've been making this documentary for years and then making some very moving testament. Do you feel that now you've been recognised and won awards, that this is really a healing process for the whole industry?
For the whole industry? I don't know. I don't know if I can speak for the whole industry. I can speak for the men.
Or more likely the people involved.
I think, yeah, definitely for the people involved. I mean, we had a private screening just for the guys in the film and their families, and it was a very emotional night, and they were all very supportive of it. They liked it. They said it was the most respectful portrayal of the film. And actually, during the world premiere at the Edinburgh Film Festival, Jeff Bollins at the end of the Q&A stood up and sort of addressed the whole audience and said, he's done a lot of newspaper articles and other programs by Powerful Rifle, but he thought that this was without a doubt the most respectful and accurate depiction of that night. So I think for them, I think, yeah, there's a certain amount of healing that's definitely gone on.
Absolutely. Anthony, many thanks for coming on the program, and congratulations again for the film. Anthony Wonke, the director of Fire in the Night, many thanks for joining us on the program. Now, contemporary writing from the African continent may not immediately jump to mind when you think of modern literature, but this weekend, the largest festival of its kind celebrating African writers kicks off here in London.
Showcasing not only writers from the African continent, but also those living abroad, is an opportunity to spread the message about this type of writing. Dubbed Africa Writes, it's the Royal African Society's annual festival. Well, we spoke to the festival organiser, Deli Miyije Fatunla, of the Royal Africa Society here in London, on what the writers from Africa's diverse literary scene are trying to articulate in their work today.
I think writers are always trying to say the new thing. They're always trying to say the difficult things. I don't think writers usually try to confirm ideas about where they're from. The literary journal Kwani, doing what's called the Kwani Manuscript Project, and they've actually just announced the winner. And the winner is a lady who's written a historical saga which is set in pre-colonial Uganda, actually, in the Kingdom of Baganda. And it's not so much necessarily trying to say new things, but it's actually writers in Africa now, and African writers, seem to be much more to be talking about their own experiences in reference to themselves and in reference to Africa itself. There seems to be much less of trying to explain Africa to the world. It's actually Africans conversing with themselves in some way, shape or form.
And you mentioned earlier the zeitgeist of the continent, of certain countries in the continent. What is that zeitgeist, especially, say, in a country like Kenya that is being very well represented at this year's festival?
Yeah. I think Kenyans, Nigerians, all the countries in Africa, especially the big ones, have a renewed sense of confidence about their prospects, economically at least. But then there's also a lot of contention about politically where these countries are going. And what you can see a lot in what a lot of the Kenyan writers are doing is this examination of the state of the nation. Kwani, I believe, did a project where they had writers talk about sort of writing in terms of the politics of the elections and discussing, if you're aware of the elections in 2007-2008, that was a very contentious election. There was a lot of post-election violence. And people are really using literature to examine that experience. So I think that's that feeling of using literature as an examination of the country's experiences is very much at the fore of what they're doing.
And the power of art, of literature, can quite often not be very tangible, can be kind of a fluid thing or something that you can't quite articulate or describe. What would you say the influence of African literature in their home countries, if you like, is at the moment, especially if there's this wave of articulating, say, things like the Kenyan elections a couple of years ago, which turned so bloody? Would you say that these writers are therefore contributing to first-time readers, say, or to actually the wider body of society, not just within the fields of literature in their countries?
Definitely. I think writers are, well, I can't remember whether it was Shelley or Byron who says, you know, poets are the first legislators of the world. But I think writers are very much at the forefront of doing that. Obviously, a lot of the time, there can be a certain sense of being embattled, because obviously the intellectual activity that writers are doing doesn't necessarily marry with the kind of the political discourse that's happening. But I think there's a big impetus amongst writers, amongst thinkers, to kind of engage with people in terms of writing. I mean, this isn't necessarily related to our festival, but there's a big impetus on, for example, in Kenya, trying to get more readers and more people aware of reading and writing. And in the past, there's been this big issue in Africa sometimes of people just thinking of reading and writing as a very utilitarian thing. And trying to convey that pleasure of literature is what a lot of people are doing now. So there's actually, I think Kwani is involved in this project where they're trying to sort of convey stories via mobile phones. So that's trying to connect the storytelling with the way that people actually engage with information, with content. So yeah, I think writers are definitely trying to, I suppose, be part of the bigger conversation happening in the countries, especially in places like Kenya.
Monocle's Tom Lewis there speaking to Delia Miyije Fortunla from this weekend's Africa Writes Festival. Well, I'm delighted to say that we're now joined on the line by Doreen Bengana, one of Uganda's most prominent short story writers. Doreen, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could give me, firstly, an insight into Uganda's contemporary fiction scene. A very difficult, really a vista there, looking at, freedom of press and also a political sort of context. I wondered, how strong is the literary scene in Uganda?
It's quite strong. I think what's happening with the censorship in the press hasn't really affected the literary scene because I guess the powers that be do not consider it to be that important, but the writers are doing what they're doing, perhaps not so overtly political work, but work that interrogates personal lives, human relationships that can in and of itself be political.
And Doreen, you won the 2006 Commonwealth Writers Prize for your book, Tropical Fish. How important are these kind of festivals, although they're not in the African continent, how important are these festivals for young African writers?
I think they're really important in sort of bringing to the forefront what the writers are doing and what the writers are saying. We don't have as much literary life as, you know, you find here. So when we're aware that things are happening in other African countries or even in the West, it makes us aware that literature still is important. Our writers are still out there. We learn more about writers in other African countries, even though the festivals might be here in London. There's that conversation going on, so we get to know more about what's happening around the world, and the writers themselves get to be read, which is the most important thing, I think.
Doreen, I wondered if you could give us an insight into really some contemporary influences that African writers are drawing on. So many people talk about Chinua Achebe when they're talking about African fiction and literature. Do you think that his legacy is really still an inspiration, or do you think that contemporary African writers are finding new canons of literature to draw on?
It's a difficult question when you're in the moment, but I would say that, yes, Chinua Achebe definitely is an influence. He still tells us it can be done. We can tell stories from our perspective, not stories that we have received, you know, through the colonial legacy, that our stories do matter and our traditions, literary traditions, exist and sort of they're these heroes that we can follow. But I think the concerns have changed a little bit. I don't know if you know, but there are these big novels that have come out recently, Americana, Ghana Must Go, and those ones seem to interrogate migration and the Africa in the diaspora. So, but on the ground, I think people are still trying to dig deeper into their personal lives and retreating a little bit away from the political scene.
Doreen Bengana, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but all the best with the festival this weekend. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's at 8:33 here in London. It's time now for a check of the world news with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Phil. Members of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood have called for a day of peaceful demonstrations in support of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi. The country's new interim leader has promised new elections, but the Brotherhood has rejected his overture to take part in talks. Islamist gunmen have carried out a series of attacks in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula region. It's not clear whether the attacks are a coordinated reaction to the removal of Mr. Morsi. North Korea has accepted a South Korean proposal for talks on the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Zone, which has been closed since April. The talks are due to take place at 10 a.m. local time on Saturday in the village where the truce which ended the Korean War was signed in 1953. President Obama has honoured the military as part of the Independence Day celebrations at the White House. He told servicemen and women that people around the world appreciate their efforts and sacrifices. A former lover of a billionaire Hong Kong tycoon has been jailed for 12 years for forging her will. Peter Chan had been found guilty of changing the will of Nina Wang, who died in 2007, to make himself the sole beneficiary of her estate, believed to be worth around $4 billion. Pakistan's new Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has met his Chinese counterpart Li Keqiang in Beijing to oversee the signing of agreements between the two allies. Mr. Sharif said the relationship between the two countries was higher than the Himalayas, deeper than the deepest sea, and sweeter than honey. Which song does that come from? Lovely. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
What is the song? What's the song? Ain't No Mountain High Enough, isn't it? Is that it?
Well, it's fairly standard love song stuff, isn't it? You know, higher than the highest mountain, love is a bit... Oh, I think he's been really...
I think he's freestyling.
Well, he kept looking to a guy next to him for prompting, really, so I'm not sure how versed he was in it.
Good stuff.
Good stuff. Well, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Phil Hahn. For today's preview of the menu, we're heading to South America. When Gusto restaurant opened its doors in La Paz, Bolivia in April, a few gourmet eyebrows were raised, a high-end establishment in the poorest country in South America.
But the man behind the project seems to know what he's doing, at least, while Danish chef-turned-entrepreneur Klaus Meyer also happens to be the co-founder of Copenhagen's Noma, an eatery that ranks among the world's best. Meyer is on a self-declared mission to change the world through food, and his sights are set on Bolivia. Ed Stalker went to meet the people behind Gusto as they bid to make the country's cuisine the next big thing in South America after the global success of Peruvian cuisine.
The Bolivian city of La Paz towers some 3,600 meters above sea level, a stunning and baffling place to build a metropolis. Visitors tend to come for the Andean scenery. As for the food, forget it. That hasn't stopped Dane Klaus Meyer opening a restaurant here, and a trip to La Paz's Rodriguez Market with Gusto sous chef Mauricio Lopez reveals why it isn't such a mad idea after all. We pass a store selling a wonderful looking trout soup from Lake Titicaca with a minty local herb known as coa, before heading, rather breathlessly given the altitude, up the hill.
Mauricio, we're in another store now, and we've got this strange fruit that I've never seen before that's kind of got a green husk. It's shaped a little bit like a banana, but just a bit straighter, with this thick green husk. What is it?
Well, this is a pacay. I don't know if there's a name in English for the fruit. Yeah, it does look like a banana. And it's green, and in the inside it's white, like completely white, and has really big seeds. On the top of the seeds is a fruit.
Okay, well, let's open it and give it a try.
Pacay is just one of the weird and wonderful ingredients I sample at the market. As I pass a store selling hundreds of different potatoes and root vegetables, including one known as the papalisa, a yellow spud-like vegetable dotted with shocks of pink. The chefs at Gusto love it here. Indeed, it's hard not to find inspiration in a place like La Paz, with the multitude of ingredients on offer, which is why Meyer firmly believes the country has so much foodie potential. Like Noma, the food at Gusto is all sourced locally, explains head chef Camilla Seidler, a 30-year-old Dane who was working in Copenhagen until she got the call from Meyer.
Food-wise, it's 100% Bolivian products. Doesn't meaning that it's Bolivian food, because I have no idea how to make that well. There's a lot of people that does that. We choose to focus on Bolivia to push it along, to get people here and to get people outside to appreciate all the biodiversity that's here. It's insane. Nobody will imagine before they're here. Going to Amazonas and just finding wild vanilla and coffee beans and chocolate beans, and I mean, it's insane.
The head chefs may be from Denmark and Venezuela, but emphasis is on getting the local community involved and delving into the country's diverse offerings. Saturday evening in Gusto, in an upmarket southern barrio of La Paz, is beginning to fill up. Scurrying around the kitchen are a fleet of local staff, including 22-year-old Estefania Morales. Estefania is from the satellite city of El Alto, even higher than La Paz at some 4,000 metres above sea level, and where the international airport is located. She grew up in a humble family, she says, and her mother is a food vendor.
I didn't know what watercress was before and hadn't eaten amaranth. I didn't realise you could prepare a dish in such a way to make it tasty. I didn't eat trout much before. I didn't really like it. And now it's my favourite dish. There are things I never thought I'd learn that I've ended up learning here. I'm really happy and I want to keep on going.
Gusto, with its sleek interiors, low wattage exposed light bulbs and striped Andean-style cushions, wouldn't look out of place in London or New York. And with a 15-course tasting menu with alcohol pairing costing 100 euros, it's unaffordable for much of the population. But the restaurant has been set up alongside the Melting Pot Foundation, a body run with Danish NGO Ibis that aims to promote food education and improve lives for local Bolivians, including Estefania, through a school. Money from the restaurant is churned back into the scheme.
What we have here is, right now we have 22 students. In a month we have 15 more coming.
Chef Camilla again.
The idea is we take them in as students. People here like to say social project and poor children and all this. That's not the way we see it. These guys work very hard. They have a European work schedule, not because we said so, but because they want so.
I've come to try the tasting menu, and the attention to detail, like with Noma, is impressive.
I'm here having an evening tasting menu. I'm on course number 5, and I've just had this amazing looking dish brought to the table. Let's have a look what's in it. We have toasted white corn, and then I think there's this corn puree underneath it. And on top we have little shreds of rabbit. Let's give it a taste. Mmm, that's pretty tasty.
Portions are bursting with colour and flavour, from the papalisa served with tender beets to the egg in a nest, that's shredded palm hearts and alpaca charqui, Bolivia's jerky equivalent. The food is fascinating, it's like diving into a magical world of ingredients. But as good as the grub is, the alcohol is also a big hit. I'd started the evening with a sangani cocktail. The spirit, a bit like Peruvian pisco, has a fragrant kick and deserves to be better known. But it's the wine that is the biggest surprise. And 23-year-old restaurant manager and sommelier Jonas Anderson is on hand to tell me a bit more.
Bolivian wine is in some ways very similar to Argentinian wine as well, except that Bolivia is taking the concept of altitude wine to the extreme. Bolivia is producing wine in up to 3,000 meters of altitude, which is a lot higher than anywhere else in the world, and that's giving a very, very unique product. Bolivia is still, I wouldn't say far behind, but the whole logistic-wise of the Bolivian wine market have definitely been a challenge.
The challenge is that, like the food, the wine in Singani market is relatively new. I try reds from Merlot to Malbec, remarkably big and juicy, and many of which can give Argentina a run for its money. For now, Peruvian is the South American cuisine of choice on global tables, but Bolivia is proving it has the diversity to match it. With an ever-growing middle class and a new wave of chefs and entrepreneurs emerging, Mayer's Bolivian risk may just pay off. For Monaco and La Paz, I'm Ed Stockton.
Tasty.
You've been wanting to do that for the whole report.
Well, when he was eating that rabbit and he just, delicious.
It was delicious.
I could really taste it as well, couldn't you?
I know, it makes me feel like going directly to La Paz. and you can catch more culinary reports from around the globe, including a craft beer brewery in Alabama and an entrepreneur making it possible to cook Michelin-style food in your own home tonight at 1900 London time.
I don't think my food would taste very Michelin star.
Possibly you might. It's for certain candidates.
I could do a killer bolognese.
They vet you first.
If you taste my bolognese, you go, tasty. Well, you are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a visit to Kenya.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle. In Hong Kong. I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keep you an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 11:45 in Dubai, 10:45 in Nairobi and 8:45 here in London. But it's to Nairobi where we're going to head next. Joining us on the line from Nairobi is Monocle's correspondent there, Tristan McConnell. Tristan, welcome to Midori House.
Morning, thanks for having me.
Morning. Well, let's start by talking about a British man, a very controversial case, Jermaine Grant, accused of planning a terrorist bombing campaign along Kenya's coast. Can you give us some update on his case?
Yeah, absolutely. Jermaine Grant was arrested a long time ago now. It's December 2011. And what this case is showing us is just how sort of slow and cumbersome the Kenyan judicial procedures can be. So it's been over 18 months now. We finally had another hearing this week. There were 3 days set aside, and we believe that the case is going to make some progress because some specialist detectives from Scotland Yard's counter-terrorism team have been flown in to provide kind of expert testimony about the evidence that they've been analysing. But in the event, during 3 days of court hearings, we've had only 4 hours of actual people in the witness stand because of lawyers failing to turn up, adjournments, late starts, early finishes, and a lot of kind of prevarication on the part of the defence. And in the end, these Scotland Yard detectives who come all the way from Britain were sent home having never actually taken the stand because apparently the defence hadn't been given sufficient time to peruse the evidence. So what this is telling us is that, you know, even in a case like this, one where, you know, there's incredibly serious charges, what this chap is accused of and his accomplices is planning to blow up, you know, hotels full of tourists all up and down the Kenyan coast. So even in a case like this, the Kenyan judiciary just isn't up to the job of getting things done efficiently. And so it's been adjourned, and I guess everyone will be back in court in late September, hoping that this time around we might get some progress.
And Tristan, another topic which you've brought up, the ban on the import of cat. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's a bit of blowback here, really. I mean, Britain is kind of falling into line with other Western countries in banning this drug cat, which is a kind of mild stimulant that you chew. It has an effect similar to having quite a few cups of espresso. It's not particularly strong, but it's very popular among Somalis. And although it's mostly Somalis who consume the stuff, a lot of the cat that's actually grown and exported comes from Kenya. And there's a large number of people involved in the industry here. And they're incredibly worried that this ban by Britain is going to kind of destroy their livelihoods. And Britain's worry in all of this wasn't so much that, you know, there are health dangers to people using cat. It's more that as every other country in Europe was banning it, Britain was inadvertently becoming the sort of the jumping off point for illegal smuggling into other countries. And I think that's what's really behind it. But the impact here in Kenya is going to be pretty serious on the farmers in this particular part of the country.
And how widely used is cat in Kenya? I mean, we here have heard that the UK is going to classify it as a C-class drug. So that will be along the lines of anabolic steroids or ketamine. I wondered, are there any sort of damaging effects to society seen from the use of cat?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite hard to unpick these things, but I mean, it, like I said, it's mostly Somalis who chew the stuff. It's a kind of cultural, social thing for them. And certainly when I visited hospitals in Somalia itself, not in Kenya, but in neighboring Somalia, you go into the sort of the mental health wards, and almost everyone in there is in for kind of cat addiction. And they do have, incredibly sort of powerful psychoses, the kind of thing that we might see in Britain from people who've been taking hallucinogenic drugs or an overuse or dependency on cannabis. But it's very hard to unpick whether, you know, is this something that was directly caused by the cat or was it something that was there before and is exacerbated? And of course, in a place like Somalia, you've also got the trauma of all these years of warfare. So it's hard to tell what really is causing these psychoses, but there's certainly a kind of correlation, certainly in my experience, between some psychological issues and an over-dependence on cat.
Let's briefly touch on the conflict in Somalia. One of your topics is about Kenyan peacekeepers in Somalia, accused by the Somali government of not being neutral and worsening clan fighting, particularly in one region. I wondered whether or not and this is true, but also how this is being received in the Kenyan press.
Yeah, I mean, look, the first thing to say here is that it's really very worrying. The Kenyans are play a large part in this African Union peacekeeping mission that's sent to stabilize Somalia. And we've seen some great progress in Somalia, a lot of international focus on this, both within Africa, but also internationally, Britain, Europe, America, and others. And you know, Somalia is probably in a better state today than it has been for 20-odd years. So, you know, anything that undermines that is a serious concern. And what's been happening down in southern Somalia around the town of Kismayo is that the Kenyans chose an ally when they went in to try to deal with the Al-Qaeda affiliates in this part of the country. And their concern really was that the spillover into Kenya. So the Kenyan troops went in, they chose a local ally. And now that local ally is fighting against other clan militias. And Kenya is sticking to its guns in the sense that, you know, it's backed these guys for the last couple of years and they're continuing to back them, which is putting them at odds with both the Somali National Army and other clan militias. Now, Kenya hasn't officially responded to these allegations from the Somali government, but there's very little doubt that Kenya has chosen who to support in this particular conflict and doesn't seem willing to back down on that. And meanwhile, we're seeing some really quite horrific sporadic fighting. And just yesterday, the World Health Organization told us that over 70 people had been killed in recent days. And these are mostly civilians, right? Whenever there's fighting in these towns in Somalia, it's not so much the soldiers and the men with guns who are getting injured. You know, it's the women, the children, passers-by getting caught in the crossfire. And it really is a tragic turn of events after we've seen some really quite impressive progress in Somalia.
Well, Tristan, thank you as ever for your insights. That was Tristan McConnell, Monocle's man in Nairobi. You're listening to Midori House with me, Sophie Grove, and Phil Hunt.
You almost forgot your name there.
I think I did. Thank you for pointing that out. Time now to look through the front pages in Germany and Switzerland with Monocle's Alexa Feminich. Alexa, welcome to the studio. Now, tell us what's on the top of your agenda.
I'm going to start with something from the Tribune de Genève. It's talking about the growing rift in Belgium between the Flemish population in Flanders and the French-speaking group in the south. Because, as you know, as I think we all know, the new king, Philippe, just recently ascended to the throne after his father abdicated earlier this week. And, I mean, there's a lot of talk in the country that people are sort of doubting his abilities as a future king. He's not very charismatic. He didn't really give a speech to the country when people aren't just, you know, they're a little bit apprehensive about what he's going to do. And, you know, on one hand, there is the Flemish side who are sort of saying, do we need a king anymore? We need to revolutionize this monarchy. We need to modernize it. Whereas the French side are a little bit more, you know, they still support him.
And the French king, he abdicated the throne, obviously, because he was saying he was too old, he had poor health. But there was some controversy in the Belgian media about his role in potentially fathering a child. This young woman is requesting that there's a DNA test from members of the royal family to kind of prove whether indeed she is the daughter of the king. How much has that been playing in the Belgian media?
I mean, you always have these sort of scandals, right, whenever anything like this happens. At least in the Swiss news, they were just more focusing on, you know, the aspect of what is the role of a monarchy in, you know, in our modern day? I mean, is it largely symbolic? They have a few powers here and there. I mean, you know, the king can grant amnesty. He has to give royal assent to certain laws. But at the end of the day, is it even a very important debate? You know, what role does this new king play?
Let's move on to Le Monde in France. A very interesting analysis, an editorial looking at Tunisia and the Tunisian Islamist Party following Hollande's visit and really eclipsing his visit in many ways is this analysis looking at Islamism in Tunisia. What's Le Monde's take?
Well, I touched on this briefly yesterday as well when I was talking with Phil, but basically what's happening is that the Tunisian Islamist Party is now sort of, because of what's happening in Egypt, they're trying to moderate their talk and they're trying to, you know, appease the population by saying, we're not going down this path. You don't need to worry about us. You know, we've been talking with you during this making of the constitution that's been 2 years in the making. And earlier this week on the 1st, that's when the new constitution really started being written and getting into debate. And so, you know, they're stressing that they've collaborated with people and that they're playing a mediatory role. When the events in Egypt happened, they tried to stabilize their prices. They tried to reduce the water cuts and power shortages that were happening often in the country. And there is a pressure, though, rising against the Tunisian Islamists. There's the equivalent in Tunisia called the Tamarud Group, and they've already gathered around 200,000 signatures. However, there is also debate that is, you know, 200,000 signatures really equivalent to the 2 million that they gathered in Egypt.
And this coverage was in Le Monde. François Hollande is in Tunisia mm-hmm. today. What can you tell us about that trip and what perhaps he might be announcing?
Well, it's just more of a sort of a trip to illustrate the ties between the two countries. I mean, France is a big export for Tunisia. 30% of their exports go to France. So it's largely a symbolic trip. It was the first trip that he ever made there and the first trip since 2008 when Sarkozy went. I think he's giving a talk later today and he'll probably have to address the sort of Egypt-Tunisian interplay, which will be interesting to keep our eyes on what he says there.
And you've got another story about the new faces of France and elderly immigrants. A very interesting piece looking at really a group called the Chinabias, which is the Arabic name for elder. Give us an insight into how the French press is covering this sector.
Well, actually, it's interesting because if you look at the picture, when I was in Marseille last week, I actually visited this this group. It's a group that sort of looks after these this group called the Chibani. And they're a group of immigrants who came in, largely male, and actually it means, as you said, elder in Arabic. And they came in from North Africa when they were young, in their 20s during the 1960s, seeking economic opportunities in France. And you know, so they worked a lot in heavy industry and more sort of labor-intensive employment. And often they left behind their families in North Africa. So the mothers and the children would be back home and they'd be sending the remittances back to their home countries. And the women tended to stay home. And now what's happening is that you're having these Chibanias, which is sort of a play on Chibani. And what's happening is a lot of the women are coming into France now to stay with their husbands now that these husbands are old and they're marginalized and no one's sort of looking after them and the state isn't looking after them. There's a large influx.
Excellent stuff. Thanks very much. That was Monocle's Alexa Firminich there. Thanks for coming in and having a flick through this morning's French and Belgian and Swiss papers. Many thanks. That's unfortunately, though, all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Connor Fitzpatrick. Our studio manager today was the very talented Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is the latest edition of Section D. I'll be back along with Emma Nelson for Midori House at the same time on Monday. So Sophie, you're off on holiday, aren't you? From Monday?
I'm off to the Hebrides.
Well, enjoy, though. Enjoy it.
Thank you very much. Well, it's time for us to say goodbye and have a great weekend.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.